of atheistic arguments. Actually, we really didn't spend that much time talking about it last week. But basically, atheism is self-refuting because, you know, you'd have to be God, you'd have to be all-knowing to disprove God's existence. And then the stronger form of agnosticism, which is now being called atheism, the idea that we can't know anything about God, well, that's also self-refuting because you'd have to know something about God to know that nothing can be known about God. So that having been said, let's take a look at some of the atheist arguments, and just to confuse matters a little bit more, the first one we're going to look at, we just introduced it last week, is not really an atheist argument. The view that God is a product of man's imagination was not so much an argument for atheism. The atheist of that day, the atheist thinkers, just assumed that they had already won the day. Now they had to explain why 95% of the people on the planet Earth disagreed with them. So this wasn't so much a victorious argument, a powerful argument for atheism, as it was, you know, the atheists were on the ropes and were trying to explain why 95% of the people disagreed with them. And Sigmund Freud basically said, well, the fact is they're all neurotic. They all have some type of mental problem here, and they're mentally sick, and we, the intellectuals who are in the know, need to help them out. But this kind of thinking started with Ludwig Feuerbach, who argued that, you know, man feared death. You know, he feared non-existence, dying and ceasing to exist. If you need any more of these, I've got a few extra ones.
Actually, I wanted my notebook.
What?
I can find my notebook.
Yeah, if you want to borrow one and give it back later, or if you want to keep it, go right ahead. But anyway, man feared death. Primitive man feared death, just like man does today. And, you know, when we die, will we cease to exist? And so by his imagination, he invented the hereafter. And he created God by his imagination. You know, God is eternal. God is all-powerful. God is in control. Those are the things that man wants to be. And so Feuerbach argued that all theology is anthropology. That really, it's a study of man, but it's what man wishes himself to be. And Sigmund Freud argued that I talk about this in my book, The God Who Sits Enthroned. He argued that guilt was not based on anything real. That we, you know, from a biblical standpoint, guilt, we all feel guilty because we have all sinned against the holy God. So Freud had to explain this universal feeling of guilt. And this sense of guilt, this moral consciousness. And he argued that the first tribe of humans was headed by a polygamous male. And he openly admitted there was actually no evidence for his views, but people were looking for a myth because they were rejecting Christianity and they jumped on the Freudian bandwagon. You had all these little boys being born into this tribe that desired to have sex with their mothers, but they couldn't because their father was too strong. So what they decided to do was they banded together. They hated the father image. They banded together, and they killed their father. Then they felt guilty for killing him, and so that's where the guilt came into existence. They felt guilty for killing him. It really doesn't explain guilt because, you know, why should they feel guilty for killing him if there really is no guilt and there really is no such thing as right and wrong? But Freud overlooked that, and very conveniently. But they felt guilty for killing their father, so they ate his body in a ritualistic religious ceremony, and they began to offer sacrifices to the father image. Okay? Ancient mankind also feared. So basically, we inherited this, supposedly. So supposedly, little boys grow up desiring to. I thought, man, Freud must have been weird because maybe he thought everybody was like him. But I did not, growing up, desiring to have sex with my mother at all. I mean, I loved my mother, but that thought never occurred to my mind until I started reading Freud. And then when the thought came up, it was like, yuck. You know, who could think of having sex with their mother? But apparently maybe Freud did. I don't know. But anyway, mankind also feared nature. And, you know, how do you, if you're afraid of nature because of earthquakes and tornadoes and floods, how do you cry out, please, nature, don't hurt me? Well, Freud said, well, because nature was impersonal, you couldn't cry out to it. So what ancient man did was he personalized nature, personified it, and said, well, if we just take this father image and we superimpose that onto nature, then we can offer sacrifices to appease the father image, the father God image, and try to appease nature and say, and pray to nature and offer sacrifices to nature and say, please don't destroy us with an earthquake or a flood.
Wouldn't that be multiple gods, like, you know, you got to appease this god for this thing and this god for this thing? Because weren't they arguing that the original belief in God wasn't one God?
Later than Freud, and even some earlier than Freud, but it was coming from a different study. Freud was studying the mind. They were studying man from studying skeletons and archaeology, but then also studying primitive tribes. They found that the most primitive tribes were polytheistic. And so anthropological studies the reigning view used to be that the first religion was animism, where we began to see all of nature as embodied by spirits. Then from that it went to polytheism, the worship of many gods. Then it evolved into monotheism, the worship of one god. And then it evolved into the highest stage of atheism. There is no God. But now what we find out just from talking to these primitive tribes is they all say, oh, no, our ancestors used to worship the one creator God who created all the lesser gods. But we forgot his name. We forgot how to worship him. So in the meantime, we worship the lesser gods because we're afraid of them. Now, from a Christian standpoint, what they're saying is we worship demons because we fear them, but we wish we knew how to worship the one creator God, because that was the pure religion that our ancestors had, and the worship. So basically, leading anthropologists acknowledge that the original religion was worship of one creator God, an animal sacrifice to somehow appease him, or to commune with him. And you look at Genesis chapter 4, Abel's sacrifice, and that's exactly what the original religion was.
Isn't it like all the ancient Greek and Roman beliefs had a one god that had created the gods?
Usually it was by classical Greek times, it was almost totally forgotten, so it went under the title of the unknown God, and people like, you know, Christian missionaries like Paul had to try to bring that to the remembrance, but it was almost totally obliterated by the time of by the time of Christ and even hundreds of years before that. Whatever the case, Freud argued that man deifies nature and personalizes it into a father god. There's a Catholic psychologist, one of the world's leading psychologists, Paul Vitz, out of a major university back east, he basically argues that, he says, Christians, are, according to Freud, are supposed to be suffering from this neurosis. We're supposed to be neurotic, we're supposed to be psychotic, because we believe that God exists, you know, through wishful thinking, we create this father image. But Witz argues that you can look at people who believe in the existence of a personal God, especially Christians, and they come from all walks of life. They had different types of relationships with their fathers. They had different backgrounds, different jobs, different cultures. Some were victims before they became Christians. Some were victimizers before they became Christians. Some had good fathers. Some had lousy fathers. Some had absentee fathers. You just don't, you cannot find a control group and say, yeah, this group will become, or more likely to become Christians than others, because they were, you know, I mean, not only does the outcast often become a Christian, but the bully often becomes a Christian. So, I mean, you had no one control group to say, this is probably going to be one of those militant Christians because he had a problem with his father, or because he didn't have a problem with his father. You can't get a stereotypical group and say, these are the kinds of people that will most likely become Christians. But Witz argued you can do that with atheism. With militant atheists, the leading militant atheist of the 19th and 20th centuries, almost every one of them either had an extremely passive father or an absentee father, or at the very least had a big problem with his father. And so Paul Witz takes Freudian psychology and turns it on Freud himself and said, it is not the Christian who through wishful thinking invents the father image, deifies the father image. Instead, it is Freud and his atheist colleagues who have a warped desire to kill the father image because of their hatred for their father. And in other words, and by the way, I'm not even saying, and Witz is not even saying, that if a person has a problem with their father, Witz would say this, if a person has hates their earthly father, they're more likely to become an atheist. But he's not saying if they have a problem with their earthly father, if they hate their earthly father, they will become an atheist. He's not even saying that. Most guys who have a bad relationship with their father still do not become atheists. There's such a small group. However, those who do become atheists, almost, especially militant atheists, almost always had some kind of problem with their father. And so Witz says if there is a psychosis here, it's the desire to kill the father image that is so wide among atheists. Basically, this kind of projection explains false idols. In fact, there's passages, you have to read Freud on this and then read Isaiah when he talks about false idols, and you start wondering if Isaiah was a Freudian. Well, of course, Isaiah wasn't a Freudian, but when Freud describes how false idols are the products of human imaginations, it sounds a lot like how Freud was trying to explain the Christian's belief in God. In other words, Freud's views do explain false idols, but as R.C. Sproul pointed out, no one would wish for the God of the Bible. I mean, if you're going to invent, if you're saying, hey, you know what, I want to invent a God by my own imagination, why in the world would you invent a God who, number one, damns you to hell for being a sinner, and number two, condemns so many of the things human beings like doing?
Why would you invent hell in the first place?
Yeah, why even invent
That's
hell
why
in the first place?
Greeks,
yeah,
and Roman gods had so many problems because they were created by man.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they had the same problems we had.
Yeah, and in fact, excellent point, Mark, because one of the biggest problems of ancient religions that they dealt with, it was a twofold problem. Number one, you needed a God who was small enough or near enough to us to feel our pain, to know our problems, to be able to sympathize with us. Yet, we also needed a God who was so far superior to us, so far away from us, so far above us, that he could heal our pain and conquer our problems. So with the Greek gods, you ended up with gods who were either too close, and the Roman gods, the gods were either too close to us because the same problems, yeah, they felt our pain because they experienced the same problems that we have. You know, we have problems with violence, with sexual immorality. So do the gods, the false gods of Roman and Greek myths. And so the same, yeah, they felt our pain, but the same problems that were crushing us crushed them as well. And so when you try to solve that problem, you end up with a God that is so far removed from us that that God could solve our problems. Problem is, the God is so far away, the God doesn't care enough to solve our problems. He's able to solve them, but not willing to solve them. Or the ones that are so close that are willing to solve our problems, but not able to. And only in Christianity do you get a God who is so transcends humans, so far above humans, that can actually conquer our problems and heal our pain, yet is so close to us that this God has become a man and is actually knows what it's like to be rejected, knows what it's like to suffer, knows what it's like to die. And so only in Christianity do you get a God that is so far away from us, so far above us, that can conquer our greatest enemy, which is death, at the same time that is so close to us that cares enough for us to conquer our pain, has actually experienced death. But whatever the case, Freud and Feuerbach's views could explain false idols, but no one would wish for the demanding God of the Bible. Again, this is not actually an argument against God's existence. Rather, it's an attempt by atheists to explain why so many people believe in a non-existent God. It's an attempt to explain why so many people don't get what these atheists believe is so obvious. And, you know, it's like, well, only an ignoramus would reject atheism. And we don't want to call everybody ignoramuses, so maybe we have to explain, you know, psychoanalyze them and explain why their thinking has worked in that area. And, you know, I mean, if you just count heads, it makes it much more likely that it's the atheists who are the warped ones in their thinking. And I mean, if you just go on college campus and ask how many of the students believe that God exists, and yes, it's going to be a much lower percentage than those who are not in college, okay, because they're being indoctrinated in secular humanism and atheism. But just the fact that still more than half believe in the existence of some type of God would tell you that these atheists who have ruled, they have reigned in our universities and our colleges for over a generation now. It just shows you how weak the atheistic hypothesis is. And now the pagan myths are making a comeback. And Christianity had defeated the pagan myths. Modern man chose to just reject, not for any good rational reasons, but just chose to reject Christianity, and atheism does not have what it takes to lock horns with the pagan myths. And so the pagan myths are coming back. And Friedrich Nietzsche, by the way, also held to this view, this Freudian and view that was held to by Feuerbach, that God was just a myth that mankind invented through his own imagination, and how mankind grew up and the myth of God is dead. So God is dead. Traditional values have died with him. And Nietzsche argued that supermen must have the courage to create their own hard values rather than soft values of Christianity. You know, Hitler liked that type of philosophy and applied it. So I think it offers its own refutation. A.J. Ayer, Bertrand Russell was part of this school too, a school of thought called logical positivism. And basically, it used what was called the verification principle, that truth can only be found through the five senses. Actually, to be real To be more accurate, the verification principle said that for statement to be meaningful, okay, it would either have to be proven, be able to be proven through the five senses, all right, to say that this table is long, okay? We can prove that through the five senses, so that's a meaningful statement. But to say that God exists or disembodied spirits exist, you can't prove that through the five senses. So the only other way for it to be meaningful would be if it was a self-defined term, a tautology. Kind of like bachelors are unmarried males. That's true by definition. Okay? And anything else, if you can't prove it through the five senses and it's not true by definition, it's a meaningless statement. Okay? Do you realize people like even Einstein held to this in the first half of the 20th century? It was so universally accepted until, you know, Christian thinkers like Gordon Clark and even non-Christian thinkers started to realize, you know something? The verification principle doesn't even pass its own test. But so much, the verification, I would argue that the verification principle was the biggest reason, the number one reason why the 20th century was the atheistic century. In other words, the leading philosophers, the vast majority of the leading philosophers and leading scientists were all atheists, were all materialists. That's an aberration in the history of philosophy. 2,500 years in the history of Western philosophy, and every century was, for the most part, dominated by either theists, you know, those who believe in the existence of a personal God, or at least deists, believe that a personal God doesn't perform miracles, or some type, believe in the existence of some type of God. Philosophy had been dominated by believers in some type of a God or gods until the 20th century, and it was because of the logical positivist verification principle. Yet the verification principle, you know, the emperor has been shown to be without clothes. The verification principle itself was not true by definition and could not prove itself through the five senses. So basically, if talk about God, if theology is meaningless, so are talk about moral values would be meaningless, but so would logical positivism and the verification principle be meaningless. And so basically, that's been thrown out the window. Now, another way of saying that God talk or talk about God is meaningless is to say that, when you use a word of God and you use it of man, okay, a word like holy, okay, let's say Mark Banks is holy, and let's say God is holy. Now, if we say that those words mean totally the same thing, if we say that God talk about God is univocal, meaning that it has totally the same meaning, the word has totally the same meaning for God as it has for man, then when we say that God is holy and Mark Banks is holy, we would mean that Mark Banks is as holy as God. Okay, so obviously there would be a problem there. God's holiness means there's got to be something that gives it in some way a different meaning. Because, you know, he's infinitely holy. We're only finitely holy. So, some theologians and philosophers have gone, turned to equivocal language. And they say that when we say that God is holy, it means something, the word holy means something totally different than when we say that God is holy. I mean, then we say that man is holy, okay? The problem with that, because then when we say that God is holy, God talk is meaningless, because we have no idea what it means. So, others have argued for analogical language, meaning that a word used of God and of man, they're not totally the same, they're not totally different, they're similar. But the problem with that is if they're similar but they're not the same, how do we know how close it is to it? There's still no way of measuring it. And so Aquinas has been slammed because people think that when he talks about analogical language used of God, that he means that the meaning is, of the word is similar. That's not what Aquinas meant. His analogical predication meant this, that a word used of God and used of man has a univocal meaning. In other words, the word holy is defined the same way for God as it is for man, but it's predicated, applied to God in a similar, though not exactly the same way as it is applied to man. In other words, holiness means to be separated from evil. God calls Christians to be separated from evil. So we can say Mark Banks is holy and God is holy, and the word holy means exactly the same thing. However, when we apply holiness, the word holy, to Mark Banks, we apply it in a finite, limited way. When we apply it to God, we apply it in an unlimited, infinite way. Okay? So Aquinas would say our words that we use of God, because we're using finite words. For God to describe himself to man, God, the infinite God, has to use finite words to describe the infinite God. So Aquinas would say it's like an arrow that God guarantees us the arrow is heading towards the target. Though we know that our arrows are never hitting the bullseye of the target, we know they're going in the right direction. So when we say that God is holy, that means that God is infinitely holy, and we don't fully understand what that means, but we do know what holiness means, what finite holiness means, and so we know our arrows are going in the right direction. And in other words, Aquinas, in his sophisticated philosophical, theological system of thought, he showed that... if God talk is totally univocal, then what happens is we create God in our own image. God becomes limited just like us. If it's totally equivocal, totally different, then God is the totally other, and we can have no knowledge about him whatsoever. We become agnostics or pantheists. God is beyond reason.
They're just a different dimension. Yeah. The meaning is basically what you mean.
And so it's basically,
it's basically in a sense, we're at this level.
Yeah.
So, but when we use it with God, it's at this level. They try to drag him down.
Yeah. And if we only know this level, then there's no knowledge of that level. But if we have the same definition for words used of God and of us, it's on our level. We understand what the word means. So it does tell us truth about God. But how that applies infinitely goes beyond our understanding. But we do know that God is holy. Say God is holy is a true statement. Now, everything that infinite holiness entails goes beyond our understanding. So Aquinas is being slammed today by postmodernist Christians as a guy who thought he had God all figured out. Not so. Not only did Aquinas argue that we can now have exhaustive knowledge of God, in other words, we can't know everything there is to know about God. We'll be learning more and more about him through all eternity, but we'll never have him fully figured out. But he also argued that even every individual thing that we know about God, every truth that we know, we don't know exhaustively.
Well, Augustine said the same thing, practically. To understand just a small part of God is a great bliss, but and understand them all together is impossible.
Mm-hmm.
When we
mm-hmm.
God with spirit.
And see, and then what Aquinas is arguing is even to understand a small aspect of God, we don't fully understand even that aspect. Mm-hmm. We do understand some of it, but we don't fully grasp. It's kind of like we think that at this point in our lives, we're all over 20. One of us much over 20, but we think that we've totally exhausted the number one, the meaning of the number one, and all its applications. But the fact of the matter is, there are applications of the number one that we haven't even begun to entertain. And whatever the case, Aquinas saw that you needed more than similar meanings. You needed univocal meanings, but then predicated or applied to God and to man in similar but different ways. And so basically what I'm getting at is the atheists of the 20th century were not, especially the first half of the 20th century, you will get some philosophy teachers, some high school philosophy teachers, a few high schools teach philosophy. You'll get some community college philosophy teachers, and maybe a few dinosaurs even on the university level that will still hold to the verification principle, but it is dead. The 20th century was, in practice, acting out the death of God in Western civilization. But as far as the battle of ideas, the 20th century acted out the death of the verification principle. And so basically, God talk is not meaningless. And because of that, the gates have been opened wide for God talk. But because most Westerners have been convinced, indoctrinated by professors and leaders in the media that Christianity is dead, it's no longer a viable option. Since the floodgates have been opened to God talk and to the supernatural, people are turning back to the ancient myths. And, if you just choose, make a moral choice, a volitional choice, to remove Christianity from the list of viable options for worldviews, you know, atheism does not have the intellectual baggage to hold back the floodwaters of the ancient myths. Yeah. And so the ancient myths are making a comeback. Now, Jean-Paul Sartre, the French existentialist, you know, as an existentialist, he believed that man is totally free. He believed either man is free or God is free. And the existentialist starts out with the premise that man is free. So free. I mean, we're talking more than, you know, free to accept or reject Christ. Secular existentialist believes that man is so free that he comes into existence as a blank check. That, we are essentialist, and most philosophers throughout history have been essentialist. An essentialist says that essence precedes our existence. Essence is who we are or what we are, our definition, what defines us, our nature. We come into existence defined, so our essence determines our existence, that we exist, how we exist. So in other words, because I came into existence as a human being, my essence determined that my existence would not include flying without, an aircraft. You know, because I'm a human and not a bird, I don't jump off of buildings and start flying all over the place by flapping my arms, okay? Humans have freedom, but the boundaries of that freedom are determined, the limits of that freedom are determined by our essence. Well, the existentialist says, no, man does not come into existence defined, he defines himself through his existence, okay? In other words, they reject the idea that we come into existence as fallen humans who need to be saved, okay? And they say we are free to be whatever we want, and through our free choices, we actualize ourselves. So, Sartre, to Jean-Paul Sartre, another atheistic existentialist, It's not important whether you help the elderly lady across the street or whether you mug her and take her money. What's important is that you act, that you actualize yourself and you give meaning to your life. Okay? And so, you know, man comes into existence without moral laws, without a definition or a nature, and he makes himself what he is. So with this view of freedom, since man is free in the existentialist sense, God cannot exist.
And so it's strange, all these cultures in the world have laws against, you know, things like that. Mm-hmm. Even in the society of Japan, when, you know, they were totalitarian and killed people, mm-hmm. people rose up against that.
Yep. See, and
they caught something wrong.
Yeah. And Sartre would argue the problem there is that even though those cultures weren't Christian, which obviously Sartre is anti-Christian, or was anti-Christian, Sartre also would argue that those cultures, you know, the cultural mores, the cultural, culture, the traditional moral laws of a particular culture, we tell babies, this is what you are. These are the boundaries that you need to play within. And Sartre is saying that, no, all these cultures are wrong throughout the world. We come into life as a blank check and we fill out our checks ourselves. Absolute freedom. Now, obviously, with that absolute freedom, there could be no God. So in his view of freedom, either God is free or man is free. They can't both be free. So there's no room for the theistic God.
If you think about it, we would have an order.
Yeah, what you said is real interesting. Because you say, all we have is chaos. That the way Sartre would put it is that life is absurd. In other words, he would say that if God does not exist, and then it's assumed, it's presupposed in existentialist thought, if God does not exist, then life is absurd. But man needs meaning to life. We can't go through life as a blank check. We have to define ourselves. We have to fill out the check. So basically he's saying, since God does not exist, life was without meaning. Man desperately needs meaning. Therefore, we need to self-actualize ourselves by creating meaning for our lives. It's a leap of blind faith into the non-rational realm to create meaning for our lives, to create our own values. Okay, in actuality, I think that you can use existentialism as an argument for God's existence. Yeah. If all humans need meaning in life, you know, all humans need water and need food. And some humans might not find food or water and might starve to death. But just the fact that we need it seems to imply that it exists somewhere. And if we need God to give meaning to life, then it would seem to imply, you know, you can build an argument for God's existence from religious experience, from man's thirst for God, from that God-shaped vacuum. What's that?
Yeah, even more from experience, from scientific point of view also, mm-hmm. from nature. I mean, a mathematical student would know that when I wrote my first programs involving gravity mm-hmm. and the solar system, we noticed that the planets would all escape the solar system because of the way gravity worked. Mm-hmm. If we only knew the initial positions of the planets, then they would go in the right order. Mm-hmm. And because we don't know what that is, you know, they would go out of sync. So there had to be someone mm-hmm. or something that put them in order mm-hmm. so they would rotate around yep. the central point.
See, and with Sartre, in his thought, Sartre, it's kind of like atheistic materialism, just kind of, that's part of his actualizing, so he just accepts that baggage, but he's really not coming at it from a scientific standpoint. His whole thing is human freedom. Okay?
Well,
it's real weird. Sartre was in he worked for the French Resistance during World War II and then was placed in a prison camp by the Nazis. And he protested the Nazi atrocities. He was a Marxist. He backed Marxism. And So, you know, he acted like there really was such a thing as right and wrong, but for him, it was almost like the world is so horrible that there can't be a God, that the world is the way it is because we actualize ourselves,
so
and this is
for
what
him. I mean,
yeah, it's really weird. It's like he says, you know, again, the problem of evil is like the number one reason why thinkers reject God, and you know, why non-thinkers reject God as well. And it's almost like they say, well, because of my moral conscience, God can't exist because he would violate my moral conscience to allow all this stuff. But then once God doesn't exist, then we say, you know what? My moral conscience is a delusion, because there really is no such thing as objective universal morality. So it's kind of like, well, I know B doesn't exist because of A, but since there's no B, then there can't be an A. And so then we go and say, okay, well, there's no A. But then the fact of it is like, well, wait a minute. If there's no A, then maybe B does exist. I mean, you've taken out your whole grounds for rejecting God has been thrown out. Now maybe God's got to come back in the picture. I think when everything's said and done, our moral consciences are real because morality is real, but morality only makes sense if God exists. And whatever the case, he's acting like it's impossible for both man to be free and God to be free. With a less drastic view of human freedom, you know, like God gave us the freedom to jump off a 10-story building, but he didn't give us the freedom to stop ourselves halfway down, to choose, okay, I changed my mind, I'm going to stop in midair, okay? So we have a limited view of freedom. We have the freedom to reject Christ, but we don't have the freedom to reject Christ till the day we die and then spend eternity in heaven. So we have freedom to make certain choices, but we don't have the freedom to avoid the circumstance, the consequences of those choices. And so basically the Christian can respond that God in his freedom sovereignly chose to make man free, but that freedom will not override God's sovereignty, and it is a limited freedom. Sartre also argued that God, defined by the Christian philosophers, is self-caused, but that's a contradiction. And he's right, it is a contradiction to be self-caused, because for something to self-cause itself, it would have to pre-exist its own existence in order to bring its own existence about. But that's absurd to say that something pre-existed its own existence. The fact of the matter is, though, Sartre there is tilting the scales in his favor by purposely misreading and misrepresenting great Christian thinkers. When Aquinas argued that God is self-existent, he meant that God exists in his own power, but he didn't mean that God caused himself to exist. A self-existent being, or even a self-explained being of Leibniz, is not a self-caused being, but it is an uncaused being. So the Christian just argues that, hey, we don't believe that God is self-caused, we don't believe that God caused his own existence. We believe that God is uncaused, that God always existed. He needs no cause. He's the uncaused cause of all else that exists.
Basically, he is.
Yep, exactly. He is existence. We have existence because he gave it to us. But he is pure existence, pure eternal, infinite existence. And so Sartre, you know, and what you find is Sartre, just like we're going to talk about Bertrand Russell, Why I'm Not a Christian by Bertrand Russell, and I prayed before I read it thinking it was going to, you know, really be challenging to my faith to respond to Russell, and not so. It was obviously a brilliant man, possibly the most intellectual man who lived in the 20th century, yet it was a man who just chose to reject God, had no good reasons for rejecting God. He just presupposed that God didn't exist, because, you know, God basically stifled his lifestyle. And, you know, Russell was pro-gay rights. He protested World War I before being a pacifist was a popular thing. I mean, but whatever the case, you find in these thinkers that there's a hidden agenda as to why they rejected God. And that they presuppose that God doesn't exist, and then they use their intellectual power
It's to remove their guilt for their free will.
Yeah.
And I think that's what atheism is.
Some people reject morality because they already rejected God, but most of the people in that ballpark reject God.